Kala Falava, and welcome to the Global Bus Figure Success Podcast. I'm Andrew Fa'avali, your host. Every week I'll be chatting with successful Pacific people from across the globe, unpacking their stories and, more importantly, picking out insights, lessons and golden nuggets you can use to live your best life too. Talofa lava, everyone. Welcome back to the Global Bus Fika Success Podcast. Hope everyone's doing well. Our last show featured Idaho-based entrepreneur Rob Polecki, a guy who quit from public office to sell smart toilet seats. And what a trip his story was. I highly recommend, if you haven't heard it, please go back and cop a listen. He's a guy who was born in South Auckland, raised in Hawaii, and now lives in mainland USA. He scaled his toilet seat business from scratch to $5 million in the past 5 years and expects to be at about $100 million in the next 5 years. So a story of courage and of boldness and of risk and of legacy. This week, we have Dr. Sioto Alefayotunia on the show, a very, very special guest who's done really important work in many spaces across the Pacific and within Pacific communities. Not only is she special because of that, but she's also my cousin. And on top of that, she's also the one responsible for hooking me up with my wife. So she's a really qualified matchmaker as well. I'm sure she's at 100% in that space. So thank you so much, Sioto, for doing that. So the story around that was that Sioto took some time away from her role at Massey University in New Zealand and lived in Dubai with her awesome husband, Wes, for a few years. Before that, though, she was overseeing a bunch of PhD students and the postgrad program. And in that program was my wife, who was studying her PhD at the time. Nicola Tava'e was her name at the time. And despite Sioto being all the way over in the Middle East, she managed to shoot her longest range Cupid arrows over mountains and oceans and connected us together. And the rest is history. And now it's Dr. Nicola Fa'avale, and she's, I'm proud to say she's my wife. But yeah, that is an aside and a little story to start us off. Sioto is a psychologist. She's an academic and practitioner who's passionate about ensuring the field of psychology and its practical application is inclusive of Pasifika Indigenous worldviews, knowledge and experiences. So she got her PhD in psychology from Monash University in Melbourne and is now a senior lecturer at Massey Uni in the School of Psychology. She's worked as a psychologist and an academic across many fields, including education, health, criminology, community and disaster humanitarian responses. So she's worked in prisons developing successful Pacific-centered rehabilitation programs. She was a leader of the 2009 Samoan Tsunami Expert Advice Team and is providing the same for the COVID-19 response that's happening right now with a second wave hitting Auckland in New Zealand in the past couple of weeks. So she's done all that plus so much more. And what I'll do is I'll drop her links and info on the show notes because I know I'm bound to miss lots of things. What I really find interesting about Sioto's work is that she's gone through the university system, she's critically analysed what they've been teaching, and she also graduated with the highest qualification through this. From there, I love how Sioto has challenged the education system along the way, saying that what's being taught is great, but in many ways it doesn't resonate with how Pacific people see the world. So she's a thinker and she's a doer. She's deeply embedded in culture. Let's just get straight into the interview. Stay locked in. So I hope you enjoy this telenoa as much as I did. Welcome to the show, Sioto, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Kaz.
So, Sioto, do you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself, you know, the villages you're from and locating yourself in culture, and then we'll get into talking about some other things?
Sure. Well, whakamālo lava lava fionga, whakatai lava mo le ta talatala noanga foi le nei foi auli. My parents, my dad comes from the villages of Manunu. And so Manunu is actually quite a kua village, not Manono, but Manunu. Just past Salo Fata, and then his other side is from Whangamalo in Sabai, and then mum's a town girl from Matau Tutai in Apia, and then her other side is actually from Sabai in Whangae'i. So yeah, those are the villages that mum and dad hail from, and then they met here in the 60s, married, and then, yeah, three children later, cuz. Dana, I was actually the only girl of three and born in Dunedin, bred out in Otara when Dad was doing his ministry there under Reverend Ned, the late Reverend Ned Ripley. And then he got called out to Papakura, home of the brave. Otara is home of the brave and strong. Papakura, I'd say, is home of the warrior. bred out here in Papakura at a time where actually there were not many Pacific, not many Pacific families at all over here in Papakura. It was good times growing up out here.
So your dad studied at Knox College, I'm assuming, in Dunedin, then came up to Otara. How old were you when you you guys moved to Papakura?
I think I was probably around 8 or 9. I just finished like a first year at primary school. Then we came out here, and it was a real culture shock. And I didn't actually even know anything existed past Otara. So just getting in a car felt so long, you know, the drive out. Mm. And in those days, actually, the drive from Otara to Papakura, they had like that back rural road.
Yeah.
And it was all country, so we literally went past farms of animals going down Mill Road, which is actually now, because like 20-odd years later, all like housing that back road. But when we came, I just remember a time when I was sitting at the back of the car looking up at the sky and the stars were really shining bright and thinking in my mind, where are we going? And it just felt so far. And then when we got here, you know, our home was actually on 2 acres of land. So they built the presbytery, had a home there. It was immense. And, of course, you know, we were in the state house in Otara. I didn't at that time know what a state house was, obviously, just knew it was, you know, we were surrounded by all of our Pasifika families at that time. And then you come to Papakura where there's like horses and, you know, this massive backyard, you know, and you're just like, wow, you know, like just kind of another world, really.
Yeah, so Papakura is built up now, and, you know, when we come home, we go for rides around Papakura, we'll go that way to go to Maraetai and stuff. But what's it like? Because when I was growing up, remembering your house, it wasn't 2 acres and it felt like 100 acres because, you know, but even Manurewa was farmland. Is it still pretty rural where you guys are?
No, not anymore.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
All housing, yeah. So even opposite us, all the land opposite was all green fields where, you know, we had a lot of horses and things and, you know, farmers would come and grow vegetables. All of that's all housing. Yeah, everything. Wherever you can get land now, it's all housing. Yeah, all changed.
So it's
mass population in Papakura now. And they're saying Papakura is like, so they've literally divided Papakura too. So part of Papakura, and they've created this whole new Takanini suburb.
Okay.
You know, between Manurewa and Papakura, there was that Takanini.
Yeah.
But Takanini was kind of all just sort of car sales yards from, yeah, you know, yeah, back in the day, it was just car sales yards. It's a whole new town.
Yeah.
Yeah, a whole new town with a whole new electorate now. So it's up for voters to actually vote who their new MP would be for that electorate too.
Okay, so the makeup of the church when you first got there, were the families in the early church that you guys set up, were they from Papakura or did they come across with you guys from Otara?
Yeah, a lot came across from Otara, yeah. So a lot came from Otara. There were some families here. There were a few families here. A lot of families from Papakura were all Cook Islands. So the families that were here were mainly Cook Islands already. So when Dad came to do the scoping, there was probably around maybe 3 Samoan families here at that time that Dad kind of found. I mean, the majority of the Samoans were found on the pub anyway. Maybe that's why I went down psychology. No, yeah, so a lot of our elders, you know, they'd set their own rules up and then break them, like, you know, not allowed to have beer or drink in the church grounds, and then they would break their own rules. So we're kind of like this I mean, you know, I'm trying to describe it like kind of the roughnecks of PIC, as we were. The families were mainly Cook Island, and then you had some Samoan. And so Dad literally had Cook Island and Samoan. So when we grew up, we had to go to both services for Cook Islands in Samoan, and then eventually Dad became a fluent Cook Island speaker because he learnt through, you know, the scriptures, and then by talking to the Cook Islands, and then he would preach in Cook Island. So just took him, actually, he's 80 now, cousin. They just celebrated Cook Islands Language Week. Mm. And so I said to him, hey, what are you doing? You want to come? You want to come with us? So he sat in the whole time, like it was about a maybe about 3 hours of a program that they ran. And I don't think they really realized how fluent he was.
Awesome.
And then in the end, he stood up to say thank you, and they were like, wow, thanks for bringing Dad. Didn't know he could speak, and he learned from the scriptures.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when he breaks out in Cook Islands here, we just look at him and roll our eyes and go, yeah, thank you.
So PIC, can you just, because, you know, obviously it's we're trying to be a global podcast, but can you just explain a little bit about the PIC?
So PIC at the time stands for Pacific Islands Church, but it's probably PIPC, Pacific Island Presbyterian Church of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Really was kind of, I think, I call it the first diasporic church, you know, because it really was one that, it wasn't like a church that came out of Samoa or Tonga or Cook Islands and established itself here, but it was one that actually was birthed out of the Pacific people coming here. So the late Reverend Leo Teasteol, he was really kind of one of those, you know, the founding father of the PIPC in Newton at the time. And because there were so many different Pacific groups that came together, so for PIPC Newton, which was sort of the home body church, you had Samoan, you had Niue, Tokelau, Tuvalu, Cook Islands, you know, so those were in those early 60s to 70s, those were sort of like the main groups at the time. And then different ministers, like what they ended up doing was, you know, supporting different ministers to go out to outreach into the different suburbs. So I'm not too sure it'll be like in Brisbane, but I'm guessing it will be like kind of like, is it like in Logan or,
yeah,
you know, the different, the ministers will go to different suburbs. So Dad in Otara at that time was kind of seen as sort of this new area, but it was very much rural at the time. Even Otara was quite rural. But my late uncle and Reverend Ned Ripley, he was called out from Newton to come out and establish Otara. So when he came out, Mum was with Auntie Ellis, and then Mum and Dad were underneath his wing. And then literally what happened was that he got called out to come to Papakura in the 80s. So we've been out here in Papakura since like 82, yeah, roughly around 81. So yeah, over 30 years now here in Papakura.
Wow.
But yeah, the PIPC church, I would say, is quite a unique church. You know, and you'd know with your guys' church too, you know, having Cook Islands and St. Paul's and Samoan, I thought, you know, like if I reflect back on it, I think actually that's probably been the making of our versatility, you know, because we grew up, yes, in Samoan, but we also grew up with Cook Islands.
Yeah.
So we had to like be aware of other cultures from an early age and understand that other cultures have different languages and different ways of doing things. And it's okay, you know, even though like as a little child, we were like, oh man, rolling our eyes, being forced to go to the Waupo Fellowship, you know, memory verses in Cook Islands and go to it and say all these things and be like the token Samoan children, you know. But now as an adult and being able to, you know, go into those circles and be at ease in the Cook Islands church and, you know, a Cook Islands families, I feel really blessed that we actually had that opportunity within PIPC.
It's true, because yeah, at Monreal we had Niue, Cook Island, Samoan, and you know, and once a month we all had to sing, you know, a hymn from each language, and so it was like diversity really early on. And we know he was going to harmonize it. So the early church was a pivotal part of our migration into New Zealand. Is that still happening here, do you think?
No. I think actually what we're seeing now is sort of a breakdown of church, in all honesty. I think that we've had a generation of our first generation that came over and established villages through the churches, because it's interesting, you know, it's interesting to me because is that our parents came and they, you know, they set up villages first, because it was always about setting up a place that they could gather to worship. And it's interesting, I always hear them say that, you know, like even if they had a place to worship first, that's okay. They'll prioritize that over their own homes, you know. And yet you see other cultures are like, no way, man. You know, we're straight into buying our own home and setting ourselves up before we have that. And that's why I think for me it was really pivotal what our parents did. But what we're now seeing is that, okay, all the buildings are established. Was we had all those, a lot of fundraising happening for all those churches. But now that the buildings are established, you know, the next generation are moving out to other different places of spiritual worship.
Mm.
You know, so I think we're now seeing sort of a changing of the guard and different churches coming up to set up, which is great. So you've got just, I mean, you know, the plethora of churches here. Yeah. I mean, many, many, many churches upon churches, you know, in suburbs where there's more churches, you know, than there are, you know, other places of community halls, for example. Mm. But I think in that too, what we're seeing is probably more isolation and less doing things together.
Mm.
You know, and doing things across cultures, which is, I guess, part and parcel of that growing number, because we've got so many different, we've got, you know, obviously the largest population of Polynesian people in the world in Auckland City. But I think also it means that it's good that we've got all the churches, you know, in their own language groups. But I think, too, we need time to also do some things together so we can understand the differences between and within our cultures, too.
Yeah, I guess it's a fine line that we're trying to get. We're trying to go deep on our own identity and our own cultures, but we can't disregard that we live in a multicultural world and we live in a world that requires unity and harmony across very different people in many ways. And so we need to focus and be intentional in getting those cross-cultural experiences for our young people and for ourselves as well. Mm-hmm. But back to your story. So you're in Papakura. Did you go to Papakura High?
Yeah, went to Papakura High, Papakura Intermediate, Papakura High, and then straight out from there on the red bus to Auckland University. Yeah, so it was funny. Back in the day, and back in our day, we were actually quite competitive. So, and there weren't many. I mean, we were the first, I think, you know, just because of who we are, we took the first group to the Polynesian Festival for Papakura High, and that was like we were non-comp. Yeah. We're non-comp in my time, but at least we got them there to the Poly Fest. So I think that was like a huge achievement. But, you know, like Papakura was real breeding ground for me because we had lots of different students back then. You know, like the majority were Balangi and Māori.
Yeah.
Pacific, not many. But we had quite a lot of good artists come out. Oh, my goodness. The Horsemen?
Yeah, Decepticons.
At that time? Yeah, yeah. Funny story, because Mum was on the Board of Trustees, right, when those young guys were actually doing their raps. One of them will be remain nameless, had a rap that actually got him into trouble and he actually had to leave school for it. But, I mean, you know, like, I remember Mum coming home, my dear late mum, she comes in, my poor mom, she was sitting on the Board of Trustees and she didn't even know why they were up, but she was really fighting for these boys. She was like, I don't like it when the Balangi tell these boys they can't come to school, but it's just a stupid tape. No, I'll get it, Malam Lama. Why are you, what's the words? And then I was listening to the tape, I was like, okay, yep, it is freedom of expression. But vulgar, mom. So we just had to explain to Mum, you know. But I mean, like, you know, in those days, you know, that's kind of what that generation were up against,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, from Papakura as well, you know, we've had, I think, who's our most famous one? Lomi, you know, Lomi Keno?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
John, yeah. So him, I think it was John Arfo, because my younger cousin, Johnny, was all involved in it. They were all in that first 15. They were I think they were the top. And that's where they poached them all from, Sully. They poached them from Papakura. That's my claim to fame.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, St. Kitts, they did a big raid on Papakura. Sorry for those people from St. Kitts, but that's how we see it. They raided Papakura.
Yeah.
And also Joe Rokuithoko came out of, I think, James Cook.
James Cook,
but mostly out of Papakura High, John R4 in that, eh?
Yeah, it was that time. It was that time. It was after. Like, I was long gone by that time. But it was the next generation under. So that's my claim to fame for Papa Kurasi. They raided our towers.
So you jumped on the City Line bus and went to the University of Auckland and you studied psych straight away or straight into a psych degree? Or?
No, I didn't get good grades. My grades were not good. So, I mean, I just made it. I just got the university entrance, but I didn't get it that time, you know, I think it was like A or B bursary.
Yeah.
I can't remember that full. And I really wanted to do law, but I didn't actually have the marks for it. So I went in straight to do my first year of BA in the hope that I would get good marks. And then I discovered psychology by one of my education papers. And one of the education papers, you do general education, and then you do educational psychology.
Awesome.
And it was really through that I discovered psychology as an actual area and started to get interested in it. But unfortunately, it wasn't really till my master's year that I realized that, oh my goodness, it's actually the pathway for psychology. I couldn't just finish my BA and then go straight in and practice.
Yeah.
I had to then do a master's and then after the master's doing an internship and then be able to like actually work to get money to pay for my parents' mortgage.
That's a long pathway to become a registered psych. Hey.
Yeah, I mean, and it was really difficult too for me because I didn't realize it until I would just, it's almost like, you know, you just get over one, you get over the line and you think, cool, I'm in. And then you get told, and it was like, that's how I was discovering what I needed to do to actually practice as a psych.
Mm.
So I've gone back now and tried to like make that pathway more clearer for our Pacific students coming through.
Yeah. So what was it about psychology that sparked your interest?
I think if I can just think of one thing, it would actually be really around why. It was really kind of that why question, you know, why is it that we do what we do? And if whether or not it's located in our own minds, you know, physically, like in the physical science space, that different neurons or synapses or whatever, and now you know this left hand side or this right, or if it is actually a part and parcel of our environment. The subject itself was really difficult, you know, because you had to do like kind of stats papers at that time, a lot of experimental. But I think I had some really good lecturers in my like stage 3 year. Because I would read these texts and these developmental theories and think, okay, this is really good, but this doesn't explain why I do what I do, you know. Or I kind of started to think of, like, for example, Margaret Mead was one of the theorists that we had to read about around adolescent development or young people's development for Pacific. And I was like, that's not. And so it was kind of started from there. Because I was, I think because just in the family that I grew up with and in the church I grew up with, you know, I think Dad was kind of really pioneering. Like yeah. He really carved out a totally different pathway for my brothers and I. You know, like we weren't allowed to speak English at home. We only had to speak Samoan. But then that was only enabled because Mum's mum, my grandmother, couldn't speak English. So we had no choice anyway. And so, you know, like we were like these fresh bulbs at school, but then every day coming home to a village in your backyard, you know. And then at one time, like he had like a agricultural, like our whole garage. Yeah, our garage was right. Aonga Amata. So our Aonga Amata preschool started about 81, 82. That was like one of the first in Auckland, I think. So it was in our garage and it was our grandma's that ran the Aonga Amata. And then in the back, he had like this tarpaulin tent. And in the tent were all these islanders. I don't know if they're overstayers, but they needed jobs. And so we did this malanga to Samoa when I was around 12 or 13. And then they brought home all these different things to lalanga the whala to do the iakonga, turtle shells to make jewelry. And so they ran this whole horticulture and agriculture. So they were making jewelry and making gāngoa. That's it. They were carving out gāngoa. They brought wood back. And then at the same time, because we still had that massive land, they were planting, you know, cabbages, all the vegetables. So we pretty much, before Market Garden existed, we had the garden. So, yeah, I think because I grew up in that kind of environment, you know, and then we had the Aonga Amata went from the garage to an actual established preschool and the council helped. When I listened to how Dad did it at that time, it was like, you know, there are a lot of the people that helped him were all non-Pacifica. You know, his friend Ross Bailey, who was in education, came. He was married to a Samoan. He came out from education and helped write all these applications to help them get funded.
Awesome.
But early on, him and Brian Joyce, they were the Māori and Pasifika in Papakura. They're still alive, kind of like he's still alive too. They're like the kaumātuas of Papakura. So they decided early on that they Brian would go and do the marae and Dad would do the church. But we're still neighbours to this day, Andrew. The church and the kaumātua of Brian Joyce are still neighbours. So even to this day, we did a lot of things together with our Māori marae. Like, you know, our trip to Samoa as young people, like Dad went and got our tutor from the marae to come and teach us all the poi, the songs, you know, papa, kura. So, you know, so we went to Samoa and you think we'd take all the Samoan items. We took all the Māori items.
Awesome.
But that was the highlight. All of the villagers loved it that we were doing Māori songs, so we taught them all the Māori songs. But anyway, long story short, like, you know, I think one of the things about growing up in Papakura for me was that Dad kind of really set that precedent. And he had a friend of his was a Jewish financial guy who actually helped him. There was a Dad talks about it as a capitalization scheme. So all our families at that time, they all owned their own homes.
What?
So, yeah, all of the Papakura families that came over from Ōtara, they all owned their own homes. Like none of the families at that time don't have, you know, a renting or anything. So the ones that moved during the 80s and 90s, there was a capitalization scheme that was happening where if you have a certain amount of children, then that means that you're entitled to the scheme. So because of that scheme, they all had their own homes here in Papakura and settled, So, yeah.
What a legend, eh? And just to think, you know, he was a whaewhaeao primarily, but actually he was the hands and feet of the Lord's work in that he was helping people set up in terms of home ownership. We know is a massive pillar of wealth creation. We know it's another pillar of building thriving communities. And then I do remember your whole horticulture stuff in the back, and then you had your, you know, your ECE. But also the it keeps cutting across diversity in that you really embraced where you were in Papakura. Because, yeah, for me, from outside, Papakura did look a lot Bārangi and Māori, and obviously the demographics changed now, but it was cool that you guys went in and got embedded into the community. Man, your dad had a lot of vision.
Yeah, and I think for me that's probably why I don't see psychology as – early on in my study, I really found it hard to see it as quite an individual pursuit. Even though I was in psychology, I was always challenging it as well along the way. And so I think my lecturers kind of saw that and they actually liked it because they realized too and recognized that, you know, psychology isn't a one, it doesn't fit everyone, you know, because it is a science that has actually come out of, you know, the halls of philosophy in Europe and then manufactured in the universities of America and then exported out here to, you know, our mainstream Australia and New Zealand cultures. But actually, even for our Māori, in a country that is bicultural, you know, that is Treaty of Waitangi led, psychology would probably be the worst young science for us. You know, I'm not saying the worst young science for us, but as a young science, it hadn't even included, you know, like collective ways of thinking and knowing and being and doing, you know. So my whole way of growing up and thinking was definitely not in any of the textbooks that I was reading about. So when I'd read about child development, I'd be thinking about myself and going, no, there's definitely something amiss. I feel like a misfit, but I would go ahead and, you know, learn what I had to learn and do it. But it was actually in practice that it really became more strong to me about how there is a real difference in what we practice for psychology and the reality of life, especially for our Pasifika families. So, for example, I had a job as a I was doing my master's and then I saw I needed money as a poor student. So I was an assistant psych at that time in a place that's called the evidential unit. It's like a for children under five that haven't been able to disclose abuse, but also for parenting kind of assessments for children in care. Long story short, because the way in which they were thinking about how parents would be good parents for me was at odds with our way of doing family. So, for example, if a parent turned up late, for example, to an appointment to see us, that would be one of the ways in which they're not showing how much they are invested or care for their child. And yet for me, I'm thinking, how many buses did this mom take to get here? Mm. You know, like, yes, she was late, but it doesn't mean that she doesn't love her child any less. Mm. You know, yet in some of these assessments, that was part and parcel of what we had to, like, you know, tick off if they are actually deemed to be good parents.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean about the practice is showing to me how it's out of step with the realities of what's going on for our actual families.
So I love how you're advocating for reimagining and rethinking how we assess, but also the field of psychology and really being critical about where the knowledge came from and where our voices embedded in it. Do you think that we're making progress in embedding our voices into it, and do you think that we, as a people, we're being critical enough as we take up the learnings in these institutions when we do have the conflict and tension that you did, to say, hey, man, that's cool. These people wrote big, thick books, but it's not resonant with my lived experience.
I think slowly we are, you know, because we're getting the numbers in there on maths, which is good. So many more Pacific students going through, obviously going through not seeing themselves, not seeing their own lived experiences and starting to challenge the status quo of how a lot of these knowledges or theories of knowledge have been created, which is a good thing. But I think we can still do more, you know, and I think a lot of that has to do with the ways in which we think about what we're doing in research, you know. So there's the evidence-based practice, which is great, okay, but we also have to think that's also a knowledge base of thinking and knowing that has come out of time, over time, you know. So really, if you think about it, it's like the Good Lives Matter model and corrections for prisons, you know, that kind of came out at one time, and then evidence around it, or basically evidence-based practice is looking at what's actually worked and what hasn't, because at one time, a whole lot of things were being done, right, to help people in prison, to help people with behavior issues, but nothing really was gathered to see whether or not it worked. And so that's where evidence-based practice comes from. It comes from, you can run these programs, but do they actually work? Are they actually meeting the lives of the people? Because you could be also doing the same thing with, like, the vaccinations. Are they actually curing people, right? But then my take on is that what method are we using, though? Like, to actually measure evidence as well, we really need to think about what is the process that we're using to actually measure whether or not it's working. So in psychology, you know, we have, like, the straight XYZ model is what I call it. Does this behavior measure up to what they're doing? And so equals this, the hypothesis kind of method, right? For me, that doesn't work for our communities who are diasporic and are creating as they go. So the problem that we get now is that people are just working off the fly, which they have to, especially in our young youth space, right? So if you think of 274, if you think of Crosspower, they did a whole lot of amazing work working with young people on the edge. And now we've got different innovative ways of doing it. But what happens is that government says, oh, no, we need to evaluate first. Mm. But our evaluations come after.
Mm.
So what I'm saying is actually advocating for practices that reinform the evidence, practice-informed evidence, meaning whatever practices we're doing today, we need to capture those that are going to inform the evidence. Then we can look at what evidence is created for our communities, because we're the new young communities that trying to make a life in these countries.
Yeah.
So we don't have all the years of being subjected to psychology that can give us. And if you think about psychology research, a lot of it was done on university students. So the majority of psychology research is actually based on university students. So I always laugh because, you know, you hear the psychology experts on TV saying, well, stress is this and trauma is this and, you know, depression is this. But they really should be kind of putting a a preface on that to say, but a lot of that research comes from university American students, right? Yeah. Because so over 80% of psychology knowledge base comes from less than 20% of the world's population. And none of us are in any of that.
Yeah, it feels like we can both call it football, right? But in America, yeah, you play gridiron. And in New Zealand, we play rugby. In New Zealand and Australia, we play rugby. And they pass it forward and we're not allowed to. And so it's football, but it's totally different. And if you can't, you know, yeah, so when you come and transplant that and call it something, we're like, it just doesn't relate. And we don't understand the rules. We don't understand the frames. And so,
awesome analogy, Cass.
But it actually confuses you. So when you're saying things have not worked, have they not worked and things have remained neutral, or do they cause trauma on the people that they haven't worked for?
Yeah, definitely trauma, re-traumatizing. I mean, you can see that in the prison population, right? Over 50% of the prison population are Maori male.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, that's the greatest humanitarian crisis that we've got in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Mm.
And then the next upcoming is our Pacific young men, for sure. There's no doubt that they're the next population that is coming up because of the amount of trauma that's already perpetuated in society. So they've already got an open door to get into prison, and then that continues to be maintained.
How do you say that message around is it re-traumatization?
Yeah, re-traumatization.
So how do you say that? Because many of these people who are doing the re-traumatization are professionals who think they're doing good. The irony is that it's actually bringing up stories and things that are causing this re-traumatization. How do you inform people who have great intentions but may be ignorant of the impact that their work, which isn't culturally responsive or culturally embedded, has on people? How do you tell them that?
Yeah, I think for me this is the whole reason why that was the whole reason why I ended up going back to doing study, you know, and doing my PhD, because actually sometimes the only way they're going to be able to receive that is actually using the same method that they would take it in, which is by re-theorizing it. Yeah, so by re-theorizing psychology from a framework of understanding that it's really around knowledge production. So in a way, we have to produce our own knowledge that's going to retrain the psychologist. So Dr. Julia Ioannou and I, and Julia actually is one of our most senior clinical psychs in forensic psychs and in youth development. She's done amazing work in this space. And her and I she was doing a training for our doctoral clinical psychology students. And we took them out to Ōtara. And we hosted them in Ōtara, and we had our community come in and speak, and then, you know, we shared, and then we actually allowed them to go out to the community, walk around and notice the differences, come back in. She did this simple exercise with them about, you know, what do you feel, what do you hear, you know, what do you sense? And honestly, it's so telling, you know, even they know, because the majority of them are not from South Auckland, the majority of them are over the shore. But I think for me, that's how we slowly start turning the tide, is we actually start to invest into the next generation of practitioners, you know, because I actually think they're more than millennials, they're game changers.
Mm.
You know, so I don't speak that over their lives, you know, that they don't listen, that they're into their phones. I'm like, no way, because actually those are our children. And, you know, we really need to be speaking life into them, and that they are the generation that can change things for us. So I think for me, it's actually about working with non-Pacifica as well, the next generation. Like, yes, I could go and try to battle it out with the current, but to me, they're gone already, you know.
They're the
ones that are already in there doing that work. I'm not going to convince them otherwise, but we've got a window of opportunity with the next generation of practitioners. So the more we can begin to train or to help to envelop into different ways of thinking, because one of the things that I've had to overcome too, Kaz, is my own professional arrogance, or my own cultural arrogance, I call it, because, you know, I recognize in my early stages of rethinking what I was doing in practice, I was quite anti-biology, you know, anti what they were doing and thinking they're re-traumatizing, which to an extent they were, but actually they're not doing it intentionally.
Yeah.
It's not intentional, because when I asked any one of them, they don't come to be a psychologist because they want to hurt anyone. You know, but actually the way in which our knowledge has been produced perpetuates that.
Yeah.
So for me, it was being able to actually redefine what we're doing in the knowledge space first, and then help our next generation of practitioners be the game changers, because we're not going to be around for 100 odd years, you know. So whatever we can leave for that generation, you know, because for me, that's my that's kind of like the fuel that kind of flames my fire, I suppose.
I love that too, because yeah, you know, over here in Mana Pasifika, we say yeah, we've kind of chosen the youth because we feel that they have the most agility, and they probably got the most agency. If we had to do a like a balance sheet, we feel that they got a lot of agency to really create the change that's coming, and they're going to be in the future that we hope for. They're going to arrive into that future. Maybe we won't, but I just the other thing I love is your point on. Bālangi's not actually being intentional in trying to traumatise us, but just being ignorant. And so the opposite of ignorance, or to counter ignorance, is just education. And, you know, Mālo and myself, we went to church yesterday, and the lady said, lady came up to us and said, oh, you guys look like the Bouncers. And I just did, oh.
Then I said in one lifetime we were.
Yeah, I said to Mālo, man, she just doesn't know that that's stereotyping and that's offensive, but it's not racism, it's ignorance, which is kind of racism. I feel like is intentional, and you're making a judgment and you're making an intentional decision. But yeah, so we can't really throw stones at them. You know, we do the cultural competence, and it's already a sensitive topic, so we can't go and throw stones and create the divisiveness. We need to think about the sameness. And so talking about that, do you think that clinical and cultural approaches can come together, and if so, how?
Yeah, definitely they can come together, and they should come together, you know, and I think the way in which they come together generally should be through, I'll give you an example, you know, like the Sini Matangi program, which I redevelop fit for purpose for the Whakawhaola unit, prison unit in 2007 and 2008. It's been going now for 10 years. So firstly, they had a clinical supervisor, then they had a cultural supervisor. And then over time, you know, the ideal is that you have it in one person, because really that one person should be able to house both, so that you don't get like the conflicts, you know, that can sometimes get with just the interpersonal differences as well, right? So for example, the facilitators of the program were Pasifika, but the clinical supervisor was non-Pasifika, but the cultural supervisor was Pasifika, right? So when I came on board, the first two lots of facilitators had literally walked off the job. When I came in, I had to go back and find out why did they actually leave, you know, what is going on. It's not just the high turnover. There are reasons why they've done this. In long story short, what I found out was that there was what they call, well, the clinical supervisor had basically made this assessment that the facilitators were colluding with the guys inside, the guys on the program, right? So then I had to look at this whole framework of thinking about what are they colluding with. So when I went back and had a look at it, it's things like, you know, they're laughing with them. You know, so in a forensic kind of rehabilitation program, why are you laughing with them? You should be challenging them, you know, they're distorted thinking, you know, and where the cultural supervisor did not pick them up on that, you know. So the cultural supervisor and the facilitators were on board, but the clinical supervisor was offside. So this is what I mean, like clinical and cultural should come together, and it can only come together if cultural leads first.
Awesome.
And that is how we've done it with the Sa'ini Matangi program, right? So the first thing with Sa'ini Matangi program when I came on board was them telling me, oh, no, you just got to put the two together, right? CBT, therapeutic, knowledge base, and then Pacific. And the first thing I did was actually go to my elders and ask them, what does Sa'ini Matangi mean? Because I don't even know what that means, you know. And when, like, I asked Dad first, like, what does Olaole Wingoa Sa'ini Matangi? And then when Dad told me the story of his mum, you know, when she was mai, and he said, Anga mai, you know how he says it, yeah, Anga mai seo ki nga, fai mai e seo kuma, e sile nga e alwi o le ilo a ingleo, e sa'ini makangia e le lope mo sisi fa fō, ka ua mo oi, you know. Honestly, I was just like, that is so deep, you know. And in understanding that, then I went to the late Tōwhai o Ngā Tino Vasa, and he explained it as well. And I thought, that is our actual therapeutic approach right there. You know, so ilimatangi is massive. It's healing wounds. It's actually more than just cognitive behavioral therapy because it goes beyond the mind. It actually engages the heart to heart, spirit to spirit. And that's why I say culture has to lead. So because we understood what ilimatangi meant, we could then, from ilimatangi, identify cultural principles like our cultural advisory group chose there's five, sorry, off the top of my head, which was Vā Whialo Lawa'i, Vā Tapuia, Whia Ngainga, Whaaloalo, and I think it's Whaaleleinga. So they're all Samoan concepts, but obviously because we noted that, okay, it's Samoan here because we've got a big population, but then the next iteration could be Tongan, then the next iteration would be Kokaila, but we're just leading this pattern so that we would build on what we've got first. So because we've grounded the program in those principles first, then you can see what some of the clinical aspects would be, right? So then you would be able to laugh with the guys, and then you would be able to challenge them at the same time, like, you know, with that. So you're not necessarily colluding with them. You know, it's all about Vā Whialo Lawa'i. You know, like, if you don't laugh with them, of course they're going to say, what's wrong with you? You know, yeah. You know, and then, you know, so now we see Vā Whialo Lawa'i, or the respectful space between us as we're, you know, doing therapy together, is respected. And then at a later time, we will challenge them on those things. But now we've got the tools to say why we would do what we would do.
Yeah, awesome.
Whereas previous to that, you know, it would be like, wow, they're just colluding with them and they should actually be challenging them on those distortions. But what was happening with that is when the facilitators did, of course what would happen? The relationship just broke down, and then none of them would finish the program, you know, and conflict starts, you know. It's like, what do you want to do, you know? Because the thing is, like, for us, if we don't have that it's more than just engagement for me. It's more than just engagement. It's actually respecting the space. It's not an invisible space. It's actually respecting the personhood, you know, the totality of the human being, you know, beyond who they are, but also who their genealogy is. You know, oila, or, you know, or felmek sawa, you know, or, you know, it's all that immersed in that. And I think the results speak for themselves, really. You know, I think we had one of the lead national office managers who was my contractor. He's been a clinical psych for years, and he just was blown away because we did two funnel ainga inside, and that's never been done before. And you know, these are guys that are, you know, the muscle. I mean, they're bouncers, but more than the bouncers, you know, when you've got nothing to do but just press iron every day, you come out with not a 6-pack, not a 12-pack, a 24, and it's just muscles to burn, and they're massive, you know. But, you know, to see these big grown men just break down and cry, I mean, that's what I mean, was beyond what this clinical psychologist, he could not believe what he was seeing. And a lot of that just came from, like, their relationship with their mums, for example, you know. Their mum would just say one thing, and these men would just be like a, honestly, kind of just like a blubbering mess, you know. But because I've seen that in my own family, you know, like, I've got brothers, they're really staunch, but, you know, one word from my late mum and then, And I think for me, like, that's what we had, you know, like, I took that into it.
Yeah.
I took that into it because I knew, like, these men don't need to be here. Why are you here? And when you hear, I mean, the majority of their stories, because you just think, yeah, you know, like, you're not meant to be here, you know, and you don't need to be here. And so the program itself was just about being, taking them back home, really. You know, taking them back home in their hearts, what I mean by taking them home in their hearts and reconnecting them to who they are as men of Pasifika, you know.
Man, that's beautiful, and congratulations for that program. You know, obviously, you know, we've read about it and we've seen the outcomes that have come from it. And also, not only that, but just the fact that you have lined up culture and the clinical approach in a program and through the people that are delivering it. So you've talked about that they're searching for the healing wounds, and they're searching for those healing wounds in their hearts. In a secular space like institutions that are Western, How do you reconcile the fact that, you know, so CBT is really mental and so is psychology. How do you bring in the spiritual and the totality of a person that you mentioned into the space, which is seems to be secular and without spirit?
Yeah, I think for me, again, it's just about grounding it in our principles, grounding it in what I call Pacific Indigenous psychology. And Pacific Indigenous really is what is Indigenous to to who we are within Oceania. You know, what's that original intent? And I think the thing is, we can't forget that actually our forefathers also made choices in the history of developing our countries, like Samoa. You know, if we think about Samoa, Fa'avai, Samoa, Letua, you just have to go to those nations. Like, I've even been to the Cook Islands, and, you know, everywhere in the Cook Islands there's a church, and they're beautiful churches, you know. And so for me, like, because psychology really in its formation, you know, was kind of a rejection of theology, means that we need to bring that back in, because we can't have a conversation about psychology without having a conversation about theology in the Pacific. You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, because if you look at all the Pacific nations that we actually come out of, man, they're swamped with theological colleges, you know. So if we're really going to get to the heart of our issues as Pasifika people, we need to have a conversation about how we understand our faith, how we express our faith, and actually begin to start to challenge some of those same messages, you know, for me, because also the way in which we enact our faith is also some of the ways in which we can cause depression and anger and frustration and all of these social issues that are coming out, you know. So I think for me, the both of them need to go together. So I do that actually by looking at faith-based practices that are happening in a lot of our cultural, in our communities. So I am a strong advocate for actually looking at what churches are doing and actually making church the priority of where we go to. Yeah. And church not just being about a building or a religious sect or anything. Church meaning people, you know, meaning Pasifika people. I mean, you and I are doing church right now, you know, in a way.
That's awesome. Because, yeah, if you think about it, Fiji, Tonga, you know, Tonga's motto, Fijian motto, Samoa's motto, they all reference God, and there's others, obviously. When you're talking about the church, then can we just flip over to the disaster management? I know you did stuff in 2009 around the Samoan tsunami. Now we're in COVID. How's the COVID response going for Pasifika communities, especially given there's been a lot of media coverage on it around singling out Pasifika people in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, honestly, I think the Pasifika community are doing amazing. You know, I think here we've seen them respond really fast. And unfortunately, you know, the family that was at the centre of this second lockdown outbreak for Auckland is Pasifika. But in saying that, you know, there's been a lot of really nasty stuff that has happened in social media towards them because they're pretty much outlining where they went. But the Pasifika community response has been amazing, and that has been outside of government. You know, well, they've been informing government, but they've just mobilized themselves. And again, for me, this highlights why church is a priority.
Yeah.
You know, like how we mobilize and how we respond in times of disaster is actually our strength. You know, we're very resilient, and all those connections that we already have is what comes into play here. But a lot of that isn't actually regarded in the disaster space. So I've worked in the disaster space since the tsunami. And if you look at a lot of the a lot of the knowledge base for it, a lot of it doesn't actually include even our Pacific diasporic ways of responding. So if you think in New Zealand too, we've had like this tradition and council of civil defence. And we've also, you know, only ever thought of it in terms of, you know, storms or natural disasters, natural hazards. And I would say we're now in a new era of a pandemic and of health hazards. But now we're getting what I call, what a whole lot of literature is saying, cascading disasters, meaning one on top of the other, on top of the other, right? So in Fiji, you know, there was the pandemic, and then you threw on top of that the hurricanes that are happening. Well, the same thing here in Auckland, really. You know, you've got poverty, you've got homelessness, which I would say is probably our number one social disaster, you know, and then you put on top of that, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think for me, the government and our local government really need to recognize the church as what I would say the new community humanitarian workforce. You know, like in the humanitarian space, you're used to the Red Crosses, Oxfam, Save the Children. A lot of them would ask me, oh, how come our Pacifica don't volunteer? How come they're not involved? And I'm like, do you know that every day is a humanitarian crisis?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, like, do you know every day we're involved in voluntary capacity all the time in our churches?
Yeah.
And so this is the work that I'm doing now in the knowledge space, which is really looking at our community capability as actually responses to humanitarian crises. And so you take the Mangere case, for example, you know, civil defense wasn't in there, CDM wasn't even there. That was literally the church, and the church. Yeah, no. But it was like, you know, the church partnering with the health organization, South Seas, you know. And, I mean, if you were to go behind the scenes and ask them who did it, that was just people who were connected to people, Pacifica people connected to Pacifica people. I'm pretty sure that CDM wasn't even involved in trying to mobilize them. And we see that that happened outside of any kind of funding coordination at all.
And wouldn't it be remiss of them to disregard the coordination and even the organizational structure that churches have? You know, they're really organized, they're set up well. And so, you know, this is an agency that you can use to get out there and do the Lord's work.
This is a big thing that disaster management needs to actually recognize, you know. So for me, it would be the disaster management and civil defense space recognizing churches as fully functional bodies of coordinating during disasters. Yeah.
What's some of the work, just to kind of tie it down, but what's some of the work that you're really excited about in the future that you're doing?
I think for me, it's really creating community researchers, you know, creating, I mean, I'd never, ever imagined myself as a researcher. And it's like, I always get asked to do all these formative evaluations and they're things that I used to think, oh, I don't want to do this. You know, like, why are we doing another evaluation? But the reason I was getting fed up with the evaluation is because I was fed up at the actual methods. You know, the methods in which we've been doing it for 20 years, cuz, you know. I was saying the same with literacy way back in the education days, you know. What data we're gathering is not going to tell me anything new 20 years from down the track. And I was right, you know. No data that they gathered, even when it went down ethics specific, didn't tell me anything new that we're still behind the eight ball when it comes to literacy. Right, we're still in the same place. What I was asking for is actually understanding what's at the core of our literacy differences, just like we talked about rugby and football and you know, the psychology, and that it's the same for our literacy practices. You know, like I went to Samoa, our Samoa teachers are saying, you know, like reading and writing is not top of the line for them. If they can talk, if they can engage in conversation, you know, that is what's priority. And I would say this is the same thing for us as Pacifica, you know, like we're not concentrating on reading and writing, except now we are, you know, we're kind of moving in that direction. The main thing for us is oracy, you know. So for me, I'm excited about looking at how we can create, you know, the research capability from within our own communities. So I'm really excited about looking at young people, understanding what happens to the information that they get, you know, that it's extracted from them, and how they can analyze it themselves, and how they can actually create their own data sets that can then in the future tell their own stories. So I know a lot of community agencies already have a whole lot of data.
Mm.
I mean, it's a minefield of data out there. To me, it's just like, how can we actually create a good system to help them tell their story with the data they actually already have without having to go and have another funded evaluation, So for me, I'm excited about how we can actually create capability within our community organizations to actually showcase what they're doing, showcase the practices that can reinform the evidence, which to me is what I've learned from these disaster gurus is citizen science. citizens engaged in the in their own science, right? So it's really them, like, you know, the new thing is co-design, you know, participatory action research. And but I love citizen science because I think it's, you know, us being active citizens in our own science.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. I just want to have a look at one other part of your life. You went to Dubai. You went away to Dubai for a few years. What was the biggest learning you got to reflect on? You've been doing a lot of heavy lifting in the community since you were born, being a Fefe Owls kid. And then you got to go away to Dubai and just have a little break with Wes, your wonderful husband. And what were some of the learnings of getting away?
Oh, I think... honestly, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't be standing if we hadn't gone away. You know, like, it was just time for us as a couple, but also from my own thinking space and professional development, it was time to actually draw away, to have time to think about a lot of the knowledge that was being just time to really park myself away. But also I felt like in an environment away from Aotearoa New Zealand, I got to understand how you can actually thrive outside of Aotearoa New Zealand. I think sometimes it's Pacific. I mean, I discovered so many Māori and Pacific were like doing amazing things. And actually, you know, they were leading organizations, like education organizations in the UAE, which is like, what, the richest country in the, one of the richest, you know, economies in the world. And yet a lot of Māori and Pacific, especially in education, were leading these organizations. And I think for me, I think if there was one takeaway from my time in Dubai, it's how much we can achieve outside of our place as well. And I think sometimes there's just so much, you know, there's a ceiling that we reach, and then if we don't leave it, we just go back down and then back up and back up. And then we can actually even turn on each other, which I think, if I'm really honest, is what I'm seeing happening here in New Zealand with our Pacific communities and our providers. You know, we just start kind of, there's a term in Samoan, whaingai. We just start turning each other and start seeing each other, you know. And part of that too means that we begin to get this racial profile that keeps us in that place. And I think too, here, my number one gripe with New Zealand is that our middle management and our even though our government is doing, you know, we've got some really aspirational governing ideas.
Yeah.
But our middle management is, sorry, the shite. You know, like, you know, they're not from grassroots up. You know, like, we have to look at the CEOs of a lot of these government organizations and then ask ourselves, why did they get there, even in local council? You know, why are our middle managers not Māori and Pasifika? Because actually they're the game changers. They're the ones that are actually defining the difference. And if you look at UAE, a lot of those middle managers were actually, like, a lot of our Māori and Pasifika and managers. And I think for me, living in Dubai made me realize how much more we are valued outside of our own country. Because it was outside of our race. They didn't look at our names on the CV and then discount us. You know, they looked at our actual CV content. And then they said, yes, you can do the job, give it a go. And, like, you know, our people thrive. And I've seen that happen here time and time again. I had a young Samoan girl who came from New York, amazing CV, couldn't even get a look in on some of these organizations because of her name. Yeah.
Yeah. And oh, I don't know what to say after that because, you know, that the injustice there. But in Dubai, you know, there was no racism that, you know, we both were there. I only found that there was a little bit of a narrative around the Indians because they were in the buses and they were the labour, right? But how do you think a society creates this thing where they look at the CV and it's not racialised? How do you think a society, we can get to a society where it's like Dubai, where we don't have a ceiling over us? And I didn't feel like many cultures had a ceiling over them except for the poor Indian labourers.
Yeah, and I think too, because I think over there in Dubai, they were also, I think to me, over there is a different kind of racial tension. You know, they're blatant. They're just in your face, you know, like they tell you, you know, if you're, you know, like it's us and then it's all of you. You know, so at least you kind of knew you know, like, okay, it's us Emiratis, then you, then you, then you, then you, you know. And so at least you knew, but on paper, when they looked at you, they wanted you for what you could do for their society, because really it was about the betterment of their society. Whereas over here, because we've got that long, drawn-out history of colonialism, I think what we've got to do is actually, there's, you know, I think the only way forward for us is really to have a treaty, you know, to really look at what, I feel in Aotearoa New Zealand we're a different case because we have the treaty. And I think if we can understand what that actually means for us, like for me growing up in Papakura, we understood how to work together. That could redefine the difference. And if the sway comes out from so many government agencies to community, I think the sway of not just funding, because it's beyond the funding. It's, I know people say we need funding to survive, we need funding to pay the bills. Yes, we do need money for our families to stay in jobs, but we also then need to think of lifting their wage.
Mm.
You know, like I'm working on this research project around living wage, but it's more than just a wage, it's actually the quality of that wage. Beyond just the money that they get, but what they can do with it as a whole family.
Yeah, I wasn't going to touch on this, but I just think when I come back to New Zealand, I see there's a lot of working poor.
Yeah, that's what they're talking. Actually, our last Talanoa Hubs was going to be on salvation packages for the what they call the new working poor, or the precariat. You know, so those that are actually in precarious living situations, meaning you don't know. You know, living from paycheck to paycheck, or if we're not, we're going to get one. I mean, they're calling that now from a lot of these economic standpoint, the new, you know, I guess, poverty or class or society is precariat. And then I was like, well, what is precariat? I was going, I'm going to ask our Pacific people, are we precariat? And then when I actually thought about precariat, I was like, hello, that is us. We are the precariat, because, you know, but then the flip side to that is, what do we define as the precariat, right? What do we define as the new working poor, though, too, you know, because actually if you look at the night markets, the way in which our families are producing for themselves, I mean, do we call it precariousness or the new working poor? Do we call it resilience and the new entrepreneurs? Is it also an opportunity for the new entrepreneurs to stand up, you know, and create the face masks for our own community, to sell our donuts online, to, you know, all these other things? But I do think what we do need, though, Kaz, is a better understanding of what's happening in our community. Because there's lots that's being thrown out there, but we're not really getting a good understanding of what's actually happening.
Okay. I just don't want to take too much more of your time, but I just do want to finish off on a lighter note. If you had dinner with other people, three other people, who would you invite and why?
Oh, if I could have dinner with three other people. Oh, my gosh. Number one would definitely be Oprah. absolutely fangirled her forever. So definitely Oprah. I'd have to say Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
Oprah, Michelle Obama, and it's got to be my girl Janet J.
Janet Jackson. Awesome.
Oh, just because I just... You know, I just can't get all her songs out of my head.
So three black, strong black women all succeeding over in the States.
See, that's what happens when you grow up in the Kura hood.
It's true.
Just watch TV all the time.
That's cool. Man, like, we covered so much, and really grateful for sharing your time, but also your knowledge and also your story, a little bit of your story. I thought I'd go into a bit deeper in your story, but... Man, there was so much there for the people to take away, and also just to think about what we're thinking about. I really like about you that you're a practitioner as well as an academic, so you're thinking about what you're doing and what we're doing, and then you're doing what you're doing in an informed way. So really appreciate it. Man, you come from parents who have navigated over here and then set things up, and people won't even know that because of their home ownership and because of the spiritual guidance that they've been given by your mum and dad and you guys as a family, the legacy will continue. You and it'll go beyond borders. So really blessed to have you on board, and thanks, Yeltu.
Oh, likewise, Cuz. Thank you to you and Nick and all the amazing things that you guys are doing because of your parents and your legacy too.
So there it is, a cool and insightful chat that has heaps of knowledge and wisdom nuggets. It'll probably pay to go back and listen to that once over, especially if you're a student and feeling a bit uneasy about some of the content you're learning, or if you're a community practitioner or worker and not getting the outcomes you and your clients are after, it'll be useful to ponder whether culture or the lack of culture in the solutions, the advice and the diagnoses could be a reason as to why. We have to start asking ourselves, are the tools we're using appropriate? I had the privilege of doing a TED talk a couple of years back and I brought a photo up of a bent screw. And it was bent because someone was using a hammer to beat it into a plank of wood. So we had a bent screw made for a screwdriver being pummeled by a hammer. And the question I asked in that talk was, should we change the hammer for a screwdriver or should the screw just harden up? I think sometimes we're putting the responsibility on the screw to harden up or the person to harden up and change, when that's mostly true. But could it be also that the expert should really be asking if what they're advising is actually relevant, resonant and reliable for the very diverse groups of people they're working with? It's something to think about because despite the good intentions, there could be some really negative, unintended outcomes. On the flip side, Dr. Seeltu offers hope in that despite our worldviews not being part of how the science of psychology was started and formed, so Pasifika peoples weren't part of that conversation, we can still peg that back and add value to the science by adding what we know to it, by doing things like what Seeltu is doing. So once again, thanks to Dr. Seeltu for jumping on the show, for your work in our community, for your perseverance to do what you do for the rest of us, and best of all for hooking me up with my amazing wife Nicola. Nick and I and our three kids, Awo, Falani and Salamaya, are eternally grateful for you. On that note then, that's us. Next week we have Lani Rafidi, technology expert who has led the Deloitte Emerging Tech team here in Australia until recently. He's the CEO of the Internet of Things and an expert on cybersecurity practice. And I came across him while watching TV while I was babysitting my daughter a few years ago. I just saw the Samoan guy constantly popping up as the emerging tech expert. So he would always be consulted upon when conversations like driverless cars or smart cities were being raised. He was always pulled into the studio and he was pulled in many, many times. So from that, I hit him up on LinkedIn, asked him for a coffee, and here we are on a podcast. So tune in for that one. Take care for now and God bless.